This week on Lunchbox Envy. The ancestor of Nutella came in solid loaf form.
In 2008, Marmite released a special edition champagne flavour.
And in the 1980s, Madonna was sacked from Dunkin' Donuts for squirting customers with jam.
It's Brains! Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Manu, and I'm here with my fellow QI elf, Jack, and chef and food writer, Rosie.
Woohoo!
All right, so, spreads.
We had some debate about how to define this, didn't we?
Yeah, what's a spread?
So I think many arguments.
This is our first subject that is defined by use case.
Things you can spread. Textually, it needs to be spreadable.
No.
Why not?
Well, for the main reason that I wanted to do mayo, and you guys said it's a condiment.
Sorry, who told you that?
Producer Alex.
I understand why Alex told me I couldn't do mayo. It's because it's not just used for that. It's used as a condiment in more senses than it is probably spread on bread like I do. And we're waiting for Hellman's to sponsor us for the mayo episode.
I found a nice definition in Science Direct, which I was very surprised to find, which might be helpful. So food that's spread onto another food, often to complement a breakfast-type bakery product or bread, biscuits, pancakes, waffles. These include jams, jellies, chutney, dairy spreads, which includes cream cheese and spreadable cheeses.
Philadelphia.
Edible oils, which includes butter and margarine, nut butters, which includes peanut, hazelnut, and almond butters, and then finally, yeast extract spreads.
Yum.
Do we feel encompassed?
That's pretty good, I would say.
I actually do.
I just say, though, my husband and I were talking about the theme last night, and we were reflecting on how in the UK, we have a very limited lexicon of spreads. I think because of penetration in supermarkets.
Please explain what happens.
As in, like, people don't really invent new ones. There's been one new spread that I can think of and name that has actually been a success.
Wait,
in the last how many years?
It's since I've been alive.
Okay, so 45 years.
What the fuck?
Sorry, guys.
36.
Okay.
Almond butter.
No, come on. That's established. Biscoff spread. And it has really been a new addition to that shelf, right? And so the other example, maybe a good example to think of, is like in Malaysia and Singapore, they have a spread which is coconut jam, kaya.
But we
don't have coconut jam here because there's no coconuts, obviously. But like, could very much be a spread. We could get hold of it.
It's definitely a spread. It's a breakfast thing. You eat it in such an interesting way. I've never tried it. Kaya toast sounds like the most fantastically delicious, sweet, savory breakfast food I've ever seen in my life.
Can confirm. It is fantastically delicious.
We
went to Malaysia for a culinary holiday. Just me and Tom eating. That's just what we do on holiday. Kaya toast is basically two pieces of white toast sandwiched with kaya, the coconut jam, in the middle, and very cold butter.
You can see the slice.
You kind of want like sliced butter for this. You get then a very, very softly boiled egg. And when I say very, very softly, I mean like onsen egg softly, i.e. the Japanese onsen egg is so named because it's an egg that's cooked in onsens, which is the hot springs. It's not actually, but, you know, so it's under boiling that water and it just sits and sort of marinates to the point where it's basically kind of snot textured. Like the white is just white and the yolk is obviously really soft. So then you have a bowl with your very, very softly boiled egg, soy sauce and white pepper, and you dip your sweet buttery kaya toast in your hot, salty, peppery egg.
Wow.
And it is heaven.
You know, one thing I love about this dish, I mean, it's kind of sad, but it's a very cool origin story. So this is particularly in Singapore, Chinese immigrants from Haiyan, they were really slow to travel over because they were a bit more conservative. So by the time they arrived in Singapore, all of these other jobs had been taken up by different Chinese immigrants. So they had to work in the service industry, often for colonists and Europeans. And then when all of the colonists left, they were left with this kind of tradition of toast and coffee and like kind of Western breakfast, but very like local ingredients. Which is why you get the kind of coconut, but also like soft boiled and
buttered toast.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And sometimes the jam is bright green, isn't it?
Oh, really?
Yeah, sometimes.
Because it's infused with pandan, I think.
Oh. Yeah, the pandan. Damn it. Pandan tastes like popcorn, but it's a coconut jam. So it's coconutty, popcorny jam. So it's really good.
And anyway, we didn't bring it with us.
We've talked at length about something we don't have. But anyway, I suppose what I'm trying to say is like, we as Brits, kind of obsessed with spreads, but very snobby about them.
Yeah, a very limited, you know, spread of spreads.
Yeah. Like another way of defining it, I suppose, is would it be on a hotel buffet table? Like bowls of jam, Nutella, whatever, you know. Nutella is a phenomenon unto its own. Mm. Like no one has been able to make a chocolate spread like it.
I love it so much, I am not allowed to buy it.
Oh, really?
It's one of those foods like
That's why you glazed over.
I'm just thinking about it's one of the perfect foods.
Nutella's beginnings were in the early 19th century.
Yeah.
In Piemonte in northern Italy, there were cocoa shortages during the Napoleonic Wars. And that meant that chocolatiers had to turn to hazelnuts, which grew locally. And they started mixing the two together. And they created a thing which is known as gianduja.
Yeah.
Which was still sold as confectionery because it's like obviously very sweet. So it wasn't a jarred spread yet. And then when cocoa got scarce again in 1940s Europe, because World War II, there was a guy called Pietro Ferrero who was living in Alba in Piemonte. And he made a sweet paste made primarily from hazelnuts and sugar with a small amount of cocoa. So it's the same kind of idea. Adulterating your what would have been pure cocoa and sugar with a bit of hazelnut. And I think it makes a really good combination.
It certainly bloody does.
I don't know why they weren't doing it from day one. But yeah, he called it gianduiot and he sold it as a solid block. So you'd slice a whole block onto that piece of bread. So not a spread by our definition, but still goes on bread. Maybe like Tansmore, you could have like Nutella. And then in the 1950s, they reformulated it and they made a softer, more spreadable paste called super crema, which marks is basically the shift from slicing blocks off to spooning it out and spreading it. And then in 1964, it was rebranded as Nutella.
Whoever came up with the name Nutella, well done. That was very clever.
Did you see in France, the highest court in the land struck down an appeal from a family who wanted to call their daughter Nutella?
They can't tell people what they can and can't call their kids.
You can in France. And in fact, in this country, I think.
What, if there's a trademark?
No, it's not to do trademarking, but you can't like call your child like
a dumb name.
Hitler or something, you know. Okay, so, I don't know. Anyway, it's more to do with child cruelty. They ruled you would get bullied all of her life, basically.
Yeah.
25% of the world's hazelnuts go into Nutella.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Which is crazy also when you consider that Nutella's only like 13% hazelnut as well.
I guess you have a lot of Nutella-y products as well. It's not just the spread.
57% sugar.
Right, that is depressing. I suppose jam is 50% sugar, you know, what am I talking about? It's just chocolate jam.
You don't eat jam out of the jar with a spoon.
In 2013, Nutella sold 365 million kilos, which is the weight of the Empire State Building. Interestingly enough. Imagine the Empire State Building built of Nutella.
I was like, I could eat that.
Well, that's probably actually less dense than concrete, so it'd be even bigger than the Empire State Building.
What is your favourite vessel for Nutella?
A spoon. Spoon.
Okay.
No,
you like a crepe?
Hot toast.
Crumpets? I think a crumpet. A Nutella crumpet is very good. Because the thing about crumpets is the respreadability. Because they are hot and they have holes in, everything goes down a level. So you can actually just infinitely add spread to a crumpet and it will just soak it up and more until it eventually becomes a giant bloated sopping
crumpet.
Yeah.
That's another child name you're not allowed.
It is time for our first lunchbox, and today that is you, Jack.
So I've brought some Korean marmalade in a mug.
Okay.
In Korea, they have a drink called yujacha. And it's basically yuzu marmalade, but you mix it in with hot water and it's a cold remedy and national drink. Yuzu is the Japanese word and it's basically a citrus that we tend not to eat in this country because it doesn't grow naturally in Europe. But I was interested in the idea that one could make a marmalade and not put it on toast. So this is one of the things you can do with basically marmalade.
I can see that, hot marmalade.
Mm.
Marmalade in like marinades and sauces is very delicious.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's lovely.
Isn't it good?
That's heaven. Mm. That's the first nice thing you've brought in years.
Wow.
Mm. Ooh. Where did you get it? At the Korean shop?
Yes, I did, actually.
Nice.
So there is a legend. Apparently, there was a man carrying yuja trees to Korea from China. And then his ship got struck by a storm and all of his trees fell overboard. And so did he. And then he got washed up on land. But luckily, there were some yuja seeds stuck in his coat.
Mm.
And then when he walked around Korea, they all fell out one by one. And then an industry was born.
Mm.
And apparently, this was very popular with King Sejong the Great, who ruled from 1418 to 1450. And he was basically Korea's national hero. He's their most popular king, partly because he invented Korean writing.
Oh, wow.
So he basically set down the rule, like, this is how you spell this. So he was quite able to spread his pro-yuja propaganda. Yeah, I think it's great. I think we should start mixing marmalade into all sorts of teas and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I was just thinking, like, arguably, squash is just jam. Squash, the drink that we drink a lot of in the UK, the kind of fruit concentrate cordials, is like mixing jam into water, basically. It's so sugary. It just doesn't have any bits.
Tokes on blunt. I think squash is basically jam.
It is.
No, you're right there. You're right. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to mark. So I'm going to talk about marmalade, but let's place it in the pantheon of fruit spreads, shall we? So you got your jams, you got your jellies, confiture. It's actually slightly different from jam. And compote. All of these essentially are sugar and fruit and some sort of cooking.
I thought confiture was the French for jam.
Okay, so confiture is a type of jam, but it's a French style. It's a lot more, it's got a lot more fruit content and gentler cooking. So it's often a bit less hard. It's softer
it's like
set.
Yeah, I know what you mean, actually. Yeah. Now you say it, I think I've had some before where you can have like spoonable, quite
bits.
Gloopy jams.
So there's no hard and fast definition, but as a rule of thumb is that English style jams, let's call them jam. If you tip a jar over your head, it shouldn't fall out onto your head, whereas a confiture might slop out. So it's a bit more runny.
Okay.
And then jelly is a clear preserve made from strained fruit juice. So there's no pulp in a jelly.
Mm.
So I don't know if you can...
set with pectin,
and
not
set
gelatin.
With pectin. So we could talk about pectin. It's the plant cell wall fibre, which forms a gel when it's heated with sugar and acid. And an underripe fruit contains more pectin, which kind of makes sense because it's harder to the touch. So you often make jam with slightly underripe fruit. And then compote is a lightly stewed fruit, which is usually looser in texture even than confiture and not designed for long-term preservation because actually that's one of the things that pectin and the sugar content does is preserves it.
Oh, yeah, my dad, he likes to fiddle around. So in the fridge right now, I've got some mango chutsal, which is apparently a halfway house between chutney and salsa.
Okay, that sounds
nice.
Cool.
Yeah, and this is his very delicious red grapefruit marmalade.
Oh, wow.
And he uses red grapefruits because they are very available all year round and you don't have to wait for like the Seville oranges to come in or anything. So there is a year-round supply of Dad's excellent marmalade.
So I want to define marmalade because only in English does it mean citrus jam. Mm.
Yeah.
So in Greek, marmalada, French marmalade, and Italian marmellata, the word means jam generally. It's just like a fruit spread.
Yeah.
And in Swedish, German and Danish, they all have a similar word to describe any fruit cooked in sugar. So that includes jellies and compotes. So why do we have this association with citrus? Well, it all comes back to friend of the podcast, Catherine of Braganza. Do you remember her from the tea episode? So marmalade in English is a jam specifically made with citrus, often oranges, sometimes grapefruit, sometimes lemon, sometimes yuzu, as we've learned.
Ooh.
But Catherine of Braganza, the Portuguese queen of Charles II, they married in 1662, so that kind of places their dates.
It was a good year.
Yeah, no great fires of London just yet. They're just about to invent a really good French beer.
Very good.
I remember niche for the heads. Cronenberg 1664.
I remember before I went to France, I sat down and learned how to say 1664 in French just because I thought it would be useful.
And?
I mean, oh my God. 1664. Oh, yeah. But it just doesn't come up. You just say Cronenberg.
Yeah. You thought that would be useful. That is so funny.
That's a window into my soul, basically. So, yeah, the Portuguese word for quince is marmelo.
Ah.
So, theoretically, the only marmalade which is allowed by definition is quince marmalade.
Oh.
But obviously, language doesn't work like that. And she brought over her own marmelo paste, i.e. quince jam. And then we sort of translated that to all other citrus.
Mm.
But these days it's made from bitter oranges from Seville. Mm. Almost all of their 4 million kilo crop every year gets exported to Britain for marmalade because we absolutely love the stuff.
It is good.
Yeah.
And it's in season January to February. So it's not... Most fruits are in season in summer, so it's quite useful. One of the other defining features of marmalade is that it often has the peel in it. Which and many fruits don't, so I think that maybe is part of it being a citrus jam. Mm-hmm.
I also find it so interesting how, like, when you think about it, when people come to the UK, when they come to London or, you know, anywhere in the UK, they want to eat jam and scones and they want to eat toast and marmalade because they are like our big, weird British idiosyncratic things that we're famous for, but like they are so ingrained in our culture, as it were, that people will seek them out.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say it's quite British because in 2019, the British Council had to apologise publicly for rejecting George Orwell's marmalade recipe for publication.
The British Council?
Yeah. So he wrote a marmalade recipe in part of an essay about British food in 1946.
George Orwell is the author of...
1984 and Animal Farm and The Road to Wigan Pier and many other things. So he also wrote a big treatise on how to make a cup of tea. So he was quite jingoistic, I think, about British food, although he wasn't afraid to criticise. He says that we have terrible coffee and also, I mean, this is 1946.
Maybe still stands.
We also boil our cabbages beyond belief. He's like, I think this is basically a guide to British food. And he's like, don't try the cabbage. It's not nice.
The British Council paid for me to go on my year abroad.
Well, that's not slam,
I can't believe me and George Orwell have this crazy 6 degrees link now.
8 years ago, though, it was reported that only 1% of marmalade sales was to under 28s. So there's a big fear that marmalade is going to die out.
Oh.
If you're under 28 and you're listening, write in if you've bought marmalade in the last week.
Maybe marmalade is something you grow into, though, because it is quite an acquired taste. Like, it is bitter. It's like drinking a Negroni. Mm. Like, I didn't like Negronis till I was at least 25, and then I was suddenly like, bitter things. I like punishment.
I was going to say, is this because our bitter taste receptors become less sensitive as we age? So say how... children and babies hate certain bitter foods like broccoli or
coffee and beer. Yeah. I mean, obviously don't give your kids beer when they're infants, but like I remember trying my mum's coffee when I was like, I don't know, 7, and I was like, well, how can you drink that?
So then we just get less sensitive to it and start enjoying the things.
I do agree, but I also think the kids who enjoy Paddington don't have disposable income, so their parents are buying the marmalade for them. So it's a bit of a misleading statistic.
Interestingly, about the taste receptors and the bitterness, I've just started weaning my son. And one of the common approaches now is to exclusively give your child the bitter foods first because you need them to get used to them before you start giving them the really nice sweet stuff. Otherwise, they will reject all the bitter stuff and only want to eat marmalade and yogurt and banana. And not that I'm giving my child marmalade, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we've been on the broccoli train all week. And let me tell you, it is unpopular as shit.
Really?
He does not like it.
Are you going to give him the world's most expensive marmalade?
Certainly not.
£5,000 a jar in 2006.
Where?
Which translates at about £76 per toast slice. Usual sort of thinness.
I love that maths there.
Thank you, yeah. It contained a rather fancy whiskey, like some sort of 35-year-aged.
What a fucking waste
and
of
also,
whiskey.
And also like Paul Roger champagne and gold leaf as well. And the sort of shortcut to any expensive food is whack some gold in there.
Cooking all of this alcohol off, aren't you, surely?
Yeah. Because I think you can add alcohol at the end just to like whisper in some flavour. Without having to boil it off. Because, yes, you would boil a lot of the alcohol and some of the flavour off.
Jam is like a high temperature thing.
Yeah.
Like, that's a burn central.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter if you burn the alcohol off because you're still getting the flavours from the... I don't know. In 2021, the world's best marmalade at the World Marmalade Awards was won by Flo Rida.
No.
the musical artist.
No, you've caught me up on the little trick here. There was a 9-year-old Scot called Flora Ryder.
Oh, right. I see.
And she won. And it was replicated and sold at Fortnum & Mason.
Oh, I was going to say, if Flo Rida is also out there winning marmalade making contests, then we have to have some discussions about where culture is going, because it's not fair that you can dominate music and jam.
You got the Snoop Dogg 19 Crimes
wine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, true.
It's all happening.
And
Jason Mraz? Big avocado farmer.
Really?
Oh,
this is crazy.
Okay, it is time for our second lunchbox, and today that is you, Rosie.
This is a real bit of me, this. I have brought for you today a Nigella Lawson recipe.
Ooh, lovely. Yeah.
Recipe is maybe a bit generous because it is two ingredients. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with Nigella's incredible innovation, Marmite butter?
No, I don't think I am. Although I did know that she did like a Marmite spaghetti, did she want?
Yes, well, similar concept. Could use this for that. So... Okay. In her cookbook, How to Eat, and the accompanying TV show. In fact, on the TV show, if the episode I remember watching is she's hosting a kids' party.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And she's basically like, what are you all doing? Spreading butter and then spreading Marmite on top of it. You can mix them together and make a Marmite butter and just do them all in one fell swoop.
But then they're all the same ratio. Sorry to argue with Nigella.
Well, I think this is important. I think we need to talk about this. Mm-hmm. Why hasn't this become more of a thing? Huh. For the listeners, I've whipped up some Marmite butter.
Ooh.
It could, and we're going to put some on
a little rush on that.
And have a nice little Marmite-y snack,
nice.
I think.
Sorry, may
would
I?
You like to?
Ooh. That's a lovely texture.
Ooh. I whipped it.
It's like
I did actually.
Dulce de leche.
Wow. That is not. I thought it was going to be like really stiff, like Marmite.
Obviously, this makes making a Marmite sandwich. Oh dear, Jack, you've had a little spillage. Much easier because you don't have to spread twice. Let's talk about Marmite a bit. So Marmite is the brand. Yeast extract is the product. Marmite is a bit like Guinness in the sense that it's synonymous with yeast extract. So I would say other brands are available, but Marmite is named after a kind of French earthenware pot called a marmite, which is what it was originally stored in. And that's what is depicted on the front of pack, which is this very iconic thing. But obviously we're Brits, so we call it Marmite.
Yeah.
And for anyone who's never seen it, it's a gloopy brown substance, very
black.
Shiny, like tar, almost black, but it goes on brown. Like when you spread it, it's more of a like mahogany. It's very enticing looking, I think, because it is so shiny and so gloopy. It looks like treacle, but it doesn't taste like treacle.
Yeah,
importantly, it's the opposite
Don't
of treacle.
Pour it on your pancakes.
Yeah, the original recipe contained excess brewer's yeast from beer production.
Oh, this is a waste product.
It's a waste product. That's where it originally came from. Salt, spices, and celery. Mm-hmm. And now they add folic acid, vitamins like vitamin B12, thiamine, and riboflavin.
Which is why it's illegal in Denmark.
What? Is it?
So the press ran lots of headlines suggesting that Marmite had been banned in Denmark, which is kind of, there's a kernel of truth to it. It's never actually been banned, but there was an importer of Marmite into Denmark in the noughties that they then discovered weren't passing the stringent tests that Denmark has for fortified foods. So Marmite is fortified, it's got lots of vitamins, and the Danes are much more careful about making sure that any fortified food has to be sort of case by case basis checked and so signed off. And this importer wasn't doing it, so they put a temporary hold on all Marmite and Vegemite.
Right. So, yeah, and it's super, supercharged umami flavour, right? Mm-hmm. There is a lot of naturally occurring MSG, monosodium glutamate, okay. in Marmite. So Marmite was first made in Burton-upon-Trent in Staffordshire.
Ah, where they brew a lot of beer.
Where they brew a lot of beer. Sense. And it was actually made on Friday the 13th in 1902.
Well, now,
significant, I think, given its weird cult status.
It's quite Halloween coded, isn't it?
Yeah. In 2010, in Burton-upon-Trent, they've put up a monument which is named the Monumite.
Oh, I love it.
That's very good.
To commemorate the fact that Marmite comes from Burton upon Trent, and it's still made there today. The Marmite plant in Burton produces.
There's a Marmite plant.
Yeah, that is.
It's a herbaceous thingy. The Marmite plant produces 50 million jars a year.
Wow.
And most of those are consumed in this country.
Yeah, that's enough for one per person in England, maybe? Mm-hmm. Almost. Mm. Founded in 1902. So it's been going for quite a long time now.
Did you know that actually after COVID there was a Marmite shortage because beer production had slowed so much, they didn't have enough brewer's yeast. So they stopped making the big jars for a while and were only making 250 gram jars because people were asking, like, where are the squeezy old Marmites at? Mm. Like, you know, the big ones. How long does it take your household to get through a jar of Marmite?
Oh, years. Mm.
Really? I'm on like two or three a year at this point.
Because one of those standard jars is 250 grams. But I think what my mum actually used it quite sparsely. Mm. So that's how I've grown up enjoying it. And then you get a lot of foreigners who sort of smear it on like it's jam. And it's
interestingly, there's a fish paste popular in Scandinavia that comes in a tube. It's bright pink and it is so powerfully strong and salty. Ooh. And it's kind of similar in the sense that everyone who uses it for the first time accidentally puts way too much on and then is like, oh my God, I can't eat that. I did that. But it's obviously different because my mite's actually delicious and amazing and iconic. It is just so popular in this country and nowhere else. There's only one other country with an equivalent, which is
Australia.
Yeah. Oh,
and it is
Vegemite.
Yeah.
It's not good.
It's not good, Australia. You guys are wrong-uns for that. It's so weak.
It's like,
I'm going to stick up for them. It's not as good as Marmite, but I think it still has a place. In. Did you know in the 1920s, they briefly renamed it Parwill?
So that they doesn't help.
They could compete. So, no, honestly, it kind of makes sense when I say the slogan was, if Marmite, then Par will.
Oh.
Kind of works.
No. But Par, what's Par?
It's Dad.
Might. Par. Will.
Mum and Dad.
Oh, Mum, Par. Oh my God, it's so gentle, that comedy. Yeah. It's like not getting that at all.
Okay, it is time for our final lunchbox, and today that is mine.
It's really scaring me.
Yeah, we can see it. Shall I try and describe it?
Please do.
Okay, it looks like raw pork mince. Okay,
that is correct.
But it's been studded with raw onion, and it's got a little smiley face made of sliced black olives. The whole effect is that of a hedgehog.
It looks like something, if you're familiar with the Instagram account, 70s Dinner Party.
Oh, so good.
This looks like it should be on there.
Let's tag them.
You can tell it's not been seasoned in any way.
How do
is that the
you
worst
know
thing about
that?
It?
Well, looking at it.
Because if it was, it would be a slightly grayer. It would be discoloring in places because any of the oils and the acids in pepper, for example, or the salt would be oxidizing the meat. Like,
drawing
moisture
out.
Yeah.
This is a dish called metiga, which is pork mince hedgehog. because today I wanted to talk about spreadable meats.
Okay. Yum.
Like pate.
Exactly. So this is a German dish, a very famous German dish, a version of it, and it's called Met. Okay. Which is M-E-T-T.
Oh, no, doesn't it mean meat?
I think flesh.
Oh, that's true. That means flesh, but so, they use it to mean meat.
Exactly. Yeah, and then kind
it
of...
It just sounds like it should be meat.
No, I mean, it is. It was in the same way that in Old English, meat just meant food. Uh-huh. The same in Old German, was food.
Oh, yes, because Danish is, I'm not going to be able to pronounce it, but it's spelled M-A-D. It's probably the same root.
And that's the word for food. So met in this context now just kind of means raw pork mince. And it's a really popular spread. So it will be seasoned. It's really finely ground and you spread it on your bread and it's completely raw, which is very particular to Germany. I tried to find out whether you could eat this dish in the UK and I think it's completely illegal.
Mm. Raw pork is hella illegal in this country.
Because our supply and cold chains are really different. Mm. So in Germany, you can eat this dish because it's so heavily, what's the word?
Policed.
Yes, it's really, really heavily policed.
Bacteria, you are not allowed.
Yeah, it's
cool. That's important.
But yeah, the entire cool chain, so the way it's packaged, it's tested. You are only allowed to sell met on the day that it's been ground.
Yes.
A day after, you have to cook it and do something else with the meat.
In France, when you want to have a steak tartare, you go to the butcher, they grind it in front of you. Mm-hmm. And they say eat it today, but they also pass it through like a UV filter to kill off some pathogens just before.
Well, in this country, the reason why you can't, in most restaurants, get a burger that is cooked less than medium rare is because the law is that unless it has been ground in-house, you can't serve any ground beef at a lower temperature than that. Mm-hmm. So the reason why steak tartare is fine is because people will chop it or grind it in the kitchen that it has come into, usually on the same day. Mm-hmm. Whereas with burgers, sometimes restaurants are buying them in ready-made, sometimes they're buying in just bulk mince, and that, as you say, the cold chain is longer, therefore there's more chance for bacteria to get in, so they need to cook it to a certain temperature. I lived in Belgium for a period of time, in Brussels, and they have a sandwich there called an Américaine, which is basically a steak tartare sandwich, but it's like as easily available as like a tuna mayo sandwich. Wow. They are everywhere in every supermarket. And I was just like, how is this allowed? Like, that's raw beef. That's a raw beef sandwich, but... It apparently is. They're clearly UVing the shit out of it.
Did you try it?
No, I did not.
You gotta go back and try. So, yeah, we're not eating this in the UK, but decorating things like this, dressing food up as hedgehogs, is a very old practice.
Yes,
this particular hedgehog shape has a really long history. So there's a 15th century British manuscript that contains a recipe for a pretend hedgehog. And that is made out of a pig stomach studded with almonds. There's a similar French dish, which is made out of a sheep stomach.
Okay.
And there's a German cookbook from 1460. And he makes much tastier sounding ones. So there's like a marzipan one and a spiced ginger one, figs. It's all of the beautiful sweet things. So I've actually seen quite a few kind of old desserts that look like hedgehogs and they're all covered in almonds. A little bit like the serpentoni we spoke about at Christmas.
Yeah.
And none of them contain hedgehog.
No.
No one's eating hedgehog, surely. That's a lot of faff to eat that.
This dish was really popular in the 70s, and particularly in post-war Germany, because during the war, they had really, really strict meat rationing. Mm. And then when meat became more available, I think a lot of German people were like, okay, we can eat meat. Let's just do it. Let's go bonkers.
Yeah.
But yeah, fell out of popularity, but then had a resurgence in the late noughties. But it got so popular that someone from Hamburg started the Museum of Modern Met, where people would send in pictures of their Met art. So it's not just hedgehogs.
Was there a Met Gala ball as well?
Incredible reference.
There was one butcher who was commissioned to make a Met Damon.
Okay, we can roll with this.
I mean, I can understand, like, it's a very... Once it's really finely ground, because obviously we don't grind our pork mince that finely. Sure, You'd have to especially request that.
Yeah.
But like, I can imagine it's an incredibly malleable and shapeable substance, like clay almost. But also, pink, you would have to be, from memory, from French culinary school, did I mention? when you blend something that is high in protein really finely, mm-hmm. you have to be really careful with the temperature because it can get really claggy and sort of like gluey. So when we were doing like fish pâtés, for example, mm-hmm. we would always blend them over ice so that they stayed really soft. The protein didn't heat up and basically start to tense. So I imagine they might have to chill their machinery down in the old German butchers.
Fish paste on the rocks.
That's right.
So yeah, that is the meat hedgehog.
Great.
Mm-hmm. Apologies for the smell. But I did want to talk about a few other meaty spreads and pâtés because they are... Oh, I do love a pâté. There's also rillette, which
I love rillette,
which is really, really, really slow cooked shredded pork. So much so that it becomes like a beautiful spreadable paste.
Mm. Well, it's also because it's cooked in its fat, so it's like a confit. Like
There's also crêton, which is a Québécois. Canadian spice pork mince bread, also really fine.
Mm-hmm.
We have andouille.
Yum! I got some in my fridge.
Ooh.
Nice. Which is...
Andouille wants her?
Do you wanna?
This is an Italian spreadable sausage.
Sure.
But then the one I was really... I had to dig for this because I really wanted to talk about it. Foie gras. There's a version called bloc de foie gras avec morceau, which is bit. So it's basically fattened poultry liver.
So not goose liver.
It can be goose.
Okay, right.
It can also be duck. And normally you're just fed that in kind of a big slab of a liver chunk. And it's really, really rich. But you can get a version which is made with the offcuts. And that is spreadable, which is why I'm allowed to talk about it, I decided.
But is it... I guess pâtés are spreads, right? Mm-hmm. In the sense that like when you eat them, mm-hmm. you scoop them and you spread them.
You don't just have
a teaspoon of pâté. They go on something else, on bread. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Mm. Like, yeah.
But then... In that vein, so the fuck is mayo?
Pâté de foie gras sounds so delicious, but when you translate it directly, it's fat liver paste.
Oh,
yeah.
It's still so good.
Yeah, but very controversial.
Very, very controversial. So if it's made in the traditional sense, it is pretty gnarly. So you force feed birds so that their liver gets so big, 10 to 6 times the size of a normal. It's enormous. But... there is a lovely Spanish farmer called Eduardo Sousa who makes ethical foie gras and he doesn't force feed his birds at all. And this stuff costs about 200 euros a jar.
Wait, how much?
If you go to a restaurant, you can often get sliced pan-fried foie gras. And that is obviously not the pâté kind, but that would probably add 30 or 40 pounds to whatever you're eating.
Mm-hmm.
But that's going to be in itself like... almost 100 grams. So to have a 200 euro jar of 180 grams is a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. So foie gras is expensive, but this is like expensive. So he basically tempts the birds down and feeds them like really, really rich foods, loads of acorns. They're completely free to leave whenever they want, but they love it so much they stay and eat all of this rich food. So their livers are getting pretty intense. And then the deep, dark winter time when they're at their fattest, he hypnotizes them using a bright torch. And apparently this is like the traditional way in his family. So you're like waiting for a moonless night and then you go out with your bright light and you kind of put them into a daze and then you kill them and harvest their nice livers. And that is the ethical way.
What an upside.
I mean, yeah.
On the spectrum of ethical decisions and meat production, this is a pretty good way to go. If you have a 200 euro note lying around and you want to try some foie gras.
It's always a way, isn't it? Mm. Like expensive food is better for the animal.
Yeah. Have you ever made, I actually made it in my cookbook. I decided I couldn't be bothered to make rillettes because they take a long time to make and involve, you know, a few different processes. You cure the pork before you then confit it.
Mm.
So I bought some shredded ham hock and I just whipped it into some butter.
Wow.
Very similar. Not as delicious, but very similar. Ham hock butter. Compound butters really and truly are the answer
kicking off
to spreads.
Oh, we've covered so much stuff, and yet there's so much left to go. We haven't even talked about cream cheeses or
peanut butter.
Peanut butter, yeah.
So we're going to have to attack that in another episode. Spread this one even further.
Hey.
Slice number two.
Nice. So that is it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy. You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
You can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes, and questions by emailing us, lunchbox@qi.com.
So, Rosie, do you have any parting recipes for us?
I just gave you one. It was crumpet, Nutella, more Nutella, another layer of Nutella, Bosch.
Nice.
Sopping.
Sopping.
Sopping crumpet.
So we'll finish with this, with a trip to Waitrose in 2017, when the supermarket decided to sell empty jam jars for £2, right next to full jars of Bon Maman jam, which were on offer for £1.71.
Well, I think it's cut out all the labour of having to throw all that jam away and wash it out. I think it's a smart move.
Genius. We will see you next week. Goodbye. Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Jack Chambers, Rosie McKean, and me, Manu Onrio. It was produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.